Welcome to Forging Plowshares, a community dedicated to cultivating the peaceful kingdom of God. We hope this part of our ongoing conversation stimulates your mind and challenges your heart about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Please stay tuned at the end of the podcast for a short message about our ministry.
This is a continuation of my conversations with Megan, Shayla, and Jess, the group involved with the Women's Chapel, which Megan started. And also note that Forging Plowshares and Plowshares Bible Institute are offering an upcoming class on the Book of Romans. So if you go to our course offerings, you can sign up then for this new course, which will be starting on September 4th, or the first full week of September. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and you will note such on social media.
I don't know if it's a particularly American thing about being in church, or maybe this is true in other places, but there's this like obsessive culture of politeness where people can't have real emotions that are maybe a little bit less than like happy, joyful emotions. It's really hard to be angry or to be sad. And like, even if you are, it's okay if you're like, oh, I'm really angry because I had a fight with my brother-in-law, or I'm really sad because, you know, this dear friend of mine passed away or whatever. Like, those are kind of acceptable in church spaces. But if you say, I'm really upset with the pastor because this thing he said that he wasn't paying attention to is actually deeply problematic towards people, that's the part where people suddenly are like, oh, we can't have that conversation here. Or if you say, I am deeply, deeply, deeply lamenting the fact that the church is so broken and it's hurt people in such a deep, deep way that they're suffering with PTSD at the level of like, you know, victims of sexual assault or like guys coming back from war. Suddenly people are like, oh, I don't have that conversation. And ironically, the place I had those conversations the most, other than within kind of this women's chapel group, was in a totally secular private university. WashU had a class they did last fall that one of the ladies was on my thesis committee. She was the first one to teach it, but it was all about abuse in the church and was kind of flowing out of her own research project. She's working on a research project right now about the Catholic abuse crisis and the Southern Baptist abuse crisis and how they're similar and different. But I mean, I sat in a classroom with like 30 undergrads for like 16 weeks constantly talking about these things the church will not talk about and having these discussions and asking questions. And what was really interesting was there was only a couple of kids in that class that were Christian and were still attending church. There were several that had grown up in church and didn't really go anymore. There's a handful of like, I think there's a couple of Muslim kids. There was a pretty good contingent of like Jewish kids that had different types of Jewish experience. And then a couple of kids that had never been raised with any religion whatsoever. And every single one of them, regardless of where they had kind of come from background-wise, would always come to the same kind of like frustration of, but why? Why is it like this? Why won't people change? Why won't they do the things they know would actually make things better? And I couldn't give them an answer for that, even with all the study that I'd been doing, and like the teacher couldn't give them an answer for that because there's not really an answer for it. People just don't want to change. And I'm not always sure why. Like, some of it, I think people don't want to lose power. Some of it, people don't want to, they just don't want to change. It's too hard. Some people don't know how to apologize because they were never told they had to, and they were never shown how to do it. And therefore, they have no idea how to make a genuine apology and actually pursue restorative justice. And so, through the course of that class, it was like being constantly, like, I'd been angry for a good, like, it was way over 4 years. But, like, really intensely angry, like for that season. And I don't know what happened still to this day, really. But somehow over the Christmas break, all of the anger vanished overnight and just turned into this like deep crushing grief. And I suddenly realized the church wasn't able to handle my anger, but they also weren't able to handle my grief either. And I got stuck in this place of, I don't know where I can go to have this conversation. And like a bunch of things coincided simultaneously. I recently switched churches and I'm in a much healthier, amazing church, but I'm still very new there, especially back in the wintertime. Like I'd only been there for like barely a year at that point. So I'm like, I don't know the people very well still. I don't really know who I can burden things with. I moved out of my parents' house for a short season and was living with my brother. And so like I'm not around my mom and dad all the time to have these conversations and get their help, like, in real time. Like, I have to schedule time with my mom because she's got so many other commitments because she was back in school and helping with my niece and my nephew. And so, like, I can maybe talk to her once a week. And a lot of the, like, I have friends like Jess and like Shayla, but some of the friends, they're giving me some of their griefs and I feel bad having to give it right back, going, I can't carry this for you anymore. And so I realized somewhere along the line, I'd internalized this belief that because the church wasn't safe to go to with my problems, Jesus also wasn't safe. And I had this epiphany. Well, I describe it a little bit in my thesis where I tripped and fell back this winter. And I didn't use my hands at all to stop the fall. Like, I just went straight with my head. And I hit so hard, I bounced, my head bounced. Like, I very viscerally remember my head bouncing. And, like, I was really cut up. And I was ironically going into my doctor's office to get help with, like, panic attacks and, like, just this, like, feeling of depression. And then showed up, like, all bloody and terrified, a receptionist, which was still feel a little bad about. Like 4 or 5 days after that, I was with my parents watching the Chosen TV show. They had their in theater, like the final two episodes, and the guy who's the director got up and gave a little spiel about kind of the theme for this year was based on the passage where Jesus says, you know, give your burdens to me because I am like lowly and gentle of heart. And he was talking about that word meek or lowly and that it literally means in the dust. And the first thought I had was, I could not have gotten lower this week if I wanted to, because it was literally licking the concrete when I fell. Like, and the thought that finally like broke through into my brain was, I don't serve a Jesus that stands above me and is judging or is telling me, well, you can't do that simply because you biologically don't match what I think is appropriate for power and authority. But instead I serve a Savior who was laying there on the sidewalk with me, bleeding and frustrated and tired and sad. And that was okay, that he could handle that kind of a thing. And what I started to come away with from there was, it's okay to have anger and it's okay to have grief. And it's okay to very much verbalize all of these things and to just get it as ugly as it needs to be sometimes, because Jesus can handle that even when his church can't. And that through that process, you start to be able to embody those emotions, and it's no longer the splitting of the self where my emotional self is over here freaking the frack out, but here I am in church being really good, you know, and like having my worship moment with Jesus and everything is fine. And then I'm going to go back and try to like ignore these really painful emotions because they're just too hard to deal with. That a part of this process is realizing I don't have to separate myself out in order to follow God. As a matter of fact, the more that I try to bring myself in and try to put all the pieces together and allow that work to kind of happen, the stronger I get and the less concerned I am with maybe like one of the things I struggled with a lot because I was angry all the time and didn't know how to integrate the anger was I wanted to invite people into a conversation, but then I wanted to punch them in the face the moment I had them in. And interestingly enough, it was like every time it would like start to happen in my brain, I would hear like all the conversations we had in Axton classes and like reading the Peaceable Kingdom going, I still don't know if I could do this. Like I would hear in like the back of my head, like the voice of Jed going, just pray and paint, Megan, like don't throw chairs. It's fine. You know, like, but I wasn't capable of like actually achieving that because I was just so, so angry. And when I finally allowed that anger to transition into grief, even though it wasn't totally under my control, and then started to figure out ways to just allow that grief to happen and to like sometimes just sit and open up everything in my life and cry and cry and cry because it's just so broken and there's no fixing it at this moment, that the more that started to happen, the less confrontational I felt, but the more willing I was to challenge things, which is ironic. Like I was thinking a lot about those passages where Paul's talking about how in his weakness he's made stronger, and that I think I'm starting to kind of understand a part of what that means, that somehow in my weakest moments where I feel the most broken, I actually have the most strength because I'm no longer relying on my anger to protect me or my intellectualism to like solve this problem. I'm engaging with who I am right now in this moment with everything I know and have seen and have done and going, it's really broken and I can't fix it, but I desperately want to be able to be a part of the fix. And allow whatever happens next to be the thing that happens next. And I can invite people into that process and say, hey, you want to come sit in this pit with me? It's a really weird pit. Like, come sit. I'll show you all the features. And maybe together, if enough people come and sit and look at it, we'll figure out a way to stop chucking people in this pit. And so that's, I think, kind of where the project currently sits with the Women's Chapel. The way I think about it now is so even totally different than the way I thought about it, like, even just 6 months ago, that it's the actual art show part of it will be in a physical space, but it's also a space of welcome and invitation for people to step in, whether or not you've had experience in the church, whether or not you're a man or a woman or something kind of in between, whether or not you even agree with me. This is an opportunity for somebody to come in to see and to hear and to experience and feel all of these stories. And what you do when you leave is up to you. Like, I'm not going to prescribe that. I've got some ideas of where we could go and what needs to be done and changed. And I know a lot of the people I'm working with have some very serious ideas about what we need to do to change things. And most of them are super practical and would actually be really easy to accomplish if people could get their heads out of their butts for more than 10 seconds. But at the end of the day, it has to be something that people choose to do for themselves. And it has to be something that they do in their own community, right where they're at. And so this hopefully will be an opportunity for people inside the church and outside of the church to listen to a very special group of people that have decided they're not content with just sitting by themselves and not sharing anymore. Even when it's really terrifying to share, we get to share as a collective voice, so nobody has to do it by themselves. So that's kind of where things are going. We'll see what happens. We're in the crunch time now because I've got like 4.5 months to pull this all together. Somehow after 2 years of doing all this at WashU, I'm still not like any further ahead.
Let me ask something that I may have been slightly oblivious to. Let me just say the word purity culture. I think that this, in fact, did not exist 20, 30 years ago. At least my wife and I, we've talked about this. We don't remember this being around when we were coming up through the church. How did that impact you?
So I can say with definity, it probably didn't really exist when you and Faith were coming up in church, because I'm reading a book right now that has all the stats. There's a woman from Canada, Sheila Gregoire, who is a social science person and does a lot of writing and studying and researching around Christian teachings on like gender and sexuality. Specifically, she wrote a book with her daughter and another lady who's a statistician about marriage books that had been written, and like all the popular marriage books called The Great Sex Rescue. They pulled like, I don't know, like 20,000 women or something like that. And like, it's the biggest, most definitive study that's been done on Christian marriage practice like ever. Like looking at the messaging and how that actually impacts people's lives over time. They got the idea then to do a similar book study, but for messages that were targeted at teenagers, specifically teenage girls, and then what that did in their lives over time. And I was just reading one of the chapters was talking specifically about purity culture and like this idea that you have to be a virgin on your wedding day or else. And they pulled different types of respondents. And what they found was it's not that some of these thoughts weren't out there before, like abstinence has always been kind of a thing that church has taught, but like this hyper-focus on it like showed up in like 93, you know, like it wasn't really there. And it's interesting because I'm doing a book study right now with my mom and some other women from our various social circles. And the ladies in the group that are like over the 40 range are like, man, I never heard any of this in school or at church. Like, you know, none of this was ever a thing. But everybody that's in my age bracket is like, oh my God, this was my entire life. And the people that are a little younger than us, like more Gen Z, they're like, yeah, we've heard some of this, but it looks really different now. So yeah, that all that to say, like, it's such a recent development, even within the life of the church, but because it's been around for about 30 years now, it's starting to feel like this is how we've always done things, which goes to like just how short-sighted the Protestant church in America generally is. Until very, very, very recently, I did not really consider how much purity culture had impacted my life and determined so much of how I think about myself and others and the world around me and what my purpose is. That purity culture is like, this is a really bad example, but if you had to go get a colonoscopy done, you got to drink the prep. to be prepared to go for the procedure. Purity culture is the prep for getting into complementarianism later on. Like, it just cleans you out and makes sure that you are prepared to then accept this thing that's about to happen to you and to never ask questions about it. It's an awful example, but
like, I literally just had a colonoscopy, Megan. That is a horrible example, but it's so true. And not like the egalitarian, like kind of more chill type of complementarianism. We're talking like the hardcore, it's complementarianism that the Duggars are okay with.
Yeah. Because purity culture basically says a girl is always responsible for her own sexuality and decisions she makes, but also for every single man around her, regardless of her age, their age, whether or not they're actually a criminal or just a creepy person, like, that it's always up to her to keep everybody from doing the wrong thing. And that if she ever makes one mistake, that's it. Like, you only get to be a virgin once. And so now you're, like, irredeemably ruined, and there's nothing we can really do about it other than say, well, yeah, the blood of Jesus covers that, but, like, dude. And so it creates this very legalistic system where you can't actually account for abuse in that system. This is actually an interesting thing that I learned during this abuse in the church class, that one of the struggles that the Catholic Church abuse crisis has had is that under the way that Catholic sexuality teaching happens, they don't have a way to distinguish a priest that's molesting a child and a priest that's having a consensual affair with his girlfriend. And so those two things are put on equal footing because they're both sexual sin, when in reality, one of those is a criminal offense by somebody that's got a deep, deep problem, and one of those is just something this guy probably shouldn't be doing because he made a promise to God that he wouldn't fool around. You know, like, these things are not the same thing. And you've got a similar thing under purity culture where it doesn't matter if you were assaulted and that's why you lost your virginity, or if you chose to fool around with your boyfriend because you're both deeply committed to each other and you love each other. Those things are on the same playing field, and it makes no exception really for people who are actually being victimized. It also means that it feeds into that kind of like rape culture idea of it's the victim's fault. Like, she must have done something to deserve it. Like, whether it was something she was wearing or not wearing, whether it was a way she was acting, you know, you shouldn't have been in that kind of situation. Like, you did this to yourself. And it doesn't give her, because the way that purity culture generally is taught is, it means we don't really have sex ed and we don't teach you any kind of comprehensive vision of what it means to be a human being in a body and to exist with other human beings and bodies. Instead, we just tell you, don't do it. Don't think about it. Don't look at it. Like, don't touch that thing. That doesn't prepare people. They don't have any language to describe what's happening to them if something negative is happening to them. Like, they have no way to describe that what's happening to them is wrong. They also don't have any way to navigate when things are supposedly right. Because what they're often finding is these teachings about how if you don't have sex before you're married and you don't, like, look at, hardly talk to your boyfriend, like, you have all of these like modesty and purity culture teachings, they actually make you more likely, I think it's like one point, women who believed that they were responsible for male lust, so they have to like dress or act a certain way, are like 1.68 times more likely to end up in a sexually abusive marriage than a woman who didn't hear that or believe that. You know, they're much more, I think it was, the similar stat was, they're like 52% more likely to experience pain in sex or have vaginismus. Like, they're much more likely, it was like 30 some percent, to feel like they couldn't confront their husbands about things. Like it creates this perfect storm where you were promised, if you followed all these teachings, believed all these things, did everything right, you would be given the perfect marriage and have amazing, wonderful sex and amazing godly children with amazing godly husband. But the actual fact is, the more you buy into this, the less likely you are to be given the thing that was promised. And so, yeah, the hard part then is looking at my own life going, I believed so much of this hook, line, and sinker because nobody in my life thought anything was wrong with it. And even my parents, as much as the other things that they've kind of dodged around, like, there's so many other things like in Christian culture that they were like, well, I'm not so sure about that. Maybe we won't do that thing. You know, this was the one thing that they did do, because both of them came from very broken and dysfunctional families. They'd both been divorced once before they got married to each other and had us. and they were determined to not make the same kinds of mistakes that had been made in the past. And when they looked to the church for resources, the only resources available were ones that sold purity culture. And to them, it seemed like the better way to go, because it would keep you from making all of these mistakes. And there was no way for them to know that at the same time, it was going to create so many issues with how you see yourself and how you see other people and how you approach brothers and sisters in Christ, much less how you are in a relationship further on down the road. So that's the part that's been like very difficult to unpack and see like the impact of all of these things in my life, and realizing that some of them I may not even be able to assess until someday I might, if I'm in a relationship. Like, that might be where something comes screaming out of the closet. It was like, oh crap, I had no idea that was still in there, you know? And so, yeah, I think the church often has the best of intentions, but sometimes it doesn't actually think through what it's doing and what it's packaging and what it's selling to people. And the fact that if your pastor tells you X, Y, Z, it has a thus saith the Lord around it, whether or not he actually meant it that way. And we've got to really think through how the power dynamic within churches works. That sometimes people hear things as God said it, even if that person tried to qualify it. Like, that part of that role is being a minister in a Christian space gives this sort of thing a power and authority to it that you might not have intended, but that's the way it's going to be received. So,
was that promoted at the institution we were all at?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't. As a matter of fact, I did a project. I actually started posting on, anybody that follows me on social media is going to get some spicy things this week. I'm posting on a piece that I made called Modest is Hottest, and unpacking some of the modesty teachings that were out there. Most of which, it's a series of photos that I did. They're all based on rules that were in the student handbook when I started at Central. Every single one of them has been rewritten in the, like, the time I did the photos, it would have been 6 years since I had left Central. Not a single one of those rules is the same on the books. And ironically, they're both more strict and less strict than they used to be, which I thought was really funny. And it was interesting because, like, one of the photos, it's me in a skirt with a credit card taped to my knee. And then once the credit card's going up and down, and then another one, the credit card's going side to side. And it comes from a conversation I had with the RD at the time. It was the RD before Ann Manier. I asked her, because in the student handbook, it says your skirt needs to be a credit card's distance from the end of the skirt to your knee. And so I asked her, like, well, which way does the credit card go? Because that could determine a lot. And she's like, well, obviously it goes horizontal. I'm like, that's not obvious, because it doesn't say that in the manual. And I remember having a conversation with Shayla about it like a year or two ago, like bringing up my idea and all that. She's like, it didn't say anything about a credit card in the handbook. I'm like, oh, yes, it did. And she's like, they had changed it between when she started at school and when I started at school, because for her, it was a dollar bill, which was like,
yeah,
if you had a vertical dollar bill, like, why even bother wearing a skirt at that point? And that was, I think, one of those moments where even when I was at Central, most of the modesty rules didn't technically apply to me per se, because I didn't do anything that wild or wacky. And I didn't feel that comfortable with my body to have worn anything too crazy. And nobody ever called me out on anything. But I saw other people get called out for stuff that shouldn't have been a big deal. And it started to dawn on me that some of this was super arbitrary and like made up in the moment. And that today's purity culture modesty rules will not be the same thing 50 years from now, because they weren't the same thing 50 years ago. And that was, I think, a big part of starting to unlearn some of that. But yeah, that was definitely, there were so many rules in the student handbook that are really just purity culture.
Okay. there were rules that were not in the handbook that were enforced. So I read the handbook all the way through, because
of course.
Thanks. Hey, so I read the whole thing through, because I knew that I was giving up a lot of freedom for them to pay for my school. And I knew that that's what was happening. And I knew that I was kind of selling my soul a little bit so that I could do this, because being 20 years old and having a curfew is stupid. Like, I understand the idea behind it being nothing really good happens after 2 a.m. when you're out, and you should probably just go home and sleep. You do have class at 9 in the morning. Like, it's not like it's a bad practice. You probably should be in bed. But that it was a rule that was enforceable and punishable for an adult was dumb. And there was a whole slew of them, but I remember distinctly, I don't really care. So I don't wear shoes as much as possible. And when I don't have to wear pants, I'm not wearing pants. And if there's not something that if I'm not feeling like standing, I will sit down. And I, whether there's floor or there's couch or there's table, I will just sit. And if I'm really tired, I'll just lay down. So I would lay down on the floor a lot because I was just done. And I remember being told that it was against the student handbook for me to be laying down on the floor in a public space because that position, seeing me laying down horizontally, would be tantalizing. And I remember being like, that's not in the handbook. And I remember going to the Dean of Women and being like, it's not in the handbook. I read through the handbook. That's not a rule you can enforce on me. And they're like, okay, yes, it's not in the handbook because we don't want to have it in the handbook, but we just don't want you to do it. Because like, if we actually had to put it in the handbook, then we'd have to say that that was a thing that we don't want you to do. And I'm like, okay, but it's not in the handbook, so I'm going to keep doing it. And I remember like, and I remember going through and talking to at least 6 different guys and being like, is this a problem for you? And they're like, no.
So it was there.
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh, absolutely.
And I feel that it was highly destructive.
Totally.
In many ways. This part of it, I can't say all of the ways in which it, we can, well, there are things that we can talk about. There's Bill Gothard, who has now come out that, and of course, a lot of this, I think, was flowing out of the Bill Gothard seminars. I don't know if you, are you all familiar with who Bill Gothard was?
Nope.
No. So he's the lucky guy. He's the guy that the Duggars are, you know, they have carried on with this enthusiastic.
The Quiverful movement?
Yeah, yeah. The whole thing is Bill Gothard. Of course, Bill Gothard turns out to be a sex pervert.
Oh, shocker.
And then with the Duggars, you know, their own children turns out to be, one of them is in prison, right?
The oldest son.
Yeah. Josh.
Due to pornography. And of course, that was the continual problem at that institution. In many ways, I mean, in obvious ways, the problem with pornography, it was just everywhere. It was just so pervasive.
Yeah, it's not just at the corner store anymore. It's in your face everywhere.
In other words, it was like the purity culture throughout in that institution, but actually throughout the culture, has ended up just so highly destructive of people's lives. I think what your project is hitting upon, Megan, that in other words, we're no longer thinking of people as people, that there is this objectification that is taking place. That is compounded by this promotion of this understanding, a kind of dehumanization. I mean, isn't that one of the major?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is one of the things I actually was just writing about. Got a bunch of Instagram posts that are coming this week, that the view that women's bodies are inherently dangerous to men because God has biologically made them, in air quotes, to not be able to resist lusting after having sexual thoughts about a woman if they just even notice her, which is not how the Bible actually characterizes lust, nor is it actually how men are made, which scientific study has proven. Both men and women, this is actually a really interesting thing. It's mentioned in Sheila Gregoire's book. She mentioned the study that they talked about this. Men and women both notice and have like a, ooh, he's hot kind of like feeling equally to each other. Like the statistical difference between the two is so low, it's more likely that if you compare two women, they would have a really big like, this woman didn't notice this guy at all, this one was like, oh my god, or two men to each other. But the difference between men and women is actually practically negligible when it comes to looking, seeing, and admiring, slash maybe doing a little more than admiring. So when you say men are irredeemably like unable to stop themselves from having sexual thoughts and fantasies that they may even want to act on, you've essentially made every man a rapist, at least in his heart, with no possibility that the blood of Jesus or anything else could stop that. and you've now told every single woman in the room she is a piece of meat that must wear something that will try to keep people from thinking of her as a piece of meat, which means she's really just an object, and she will always be an object no matter what she's wearing or what she's doing. And then when you compound that with, you don't have a voice because women should be silent in church and women should not have authority over men. And you compound that with, your place is just to have kids and be in your home. You don't need a job out elsewhere. And you compound that with all of the culture around us that also tries to limit women's roles and their abilities. You end up with a group of people that are objects with no voice, no agency, and no way to get out from underneath of that. Being controlled by people who have consolidated all the power for themselves and tell everybody underneath of them, you can have this power too if you do these awful things to other people, and take a very dim view of your own self as an image of God. And that's the part that I feel like, it sounds so good and so smart. Like, it makes sense. Like Shayla was saying, like, it makes sense to tell 20 to 21 year olds, you need to be in the building by midnight because nothing good will happen if you're just out there loose, and like, you should sleep, you should do these things. That doesn't seem like a bad idea. It seems like a very good idea. But the way that we package some of these good ideas has an awful lot of damaging effect on people, because it's not necessarily a bad thing to say, you shouldn't sleep around. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to say, you should, there's certain types of clothing that are appropriate for certain situations, and for other situations, they're not. Like, if you show up to a job interview wearing a bathing suit, you're probably not going to get the job, unless the job was to be a lifeguard. But even then, probably not. You know, like, there's some practical things we can say to these situations that, like, is very different than saying, who you are as a person was created to either be an object or to be this monster that can't really be saved. And you're going to be stuck in this perpetual cycle that you can't get out of because Jesus wants it this way. And that is super inappropriate. And that was very much what was being taught implicitly and sometimes explicitly at Central. It's what was being taught very explicitly in the homeschool groups that I grew up in. It's taught implicitly and explicitly at the church I went to as a child and like a teenager and have recently left. Still technically a huge part of most Christian Protestant denominations and probably most Catholic groups as well, at least in America, that we just cannot get past this need to demonize an other one group so another group can have power. But in the process, we've made them something that Jesus can't save. And so we're all, this is a classic, like, damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of situation. And everybody's going to be hurt by this. There's no good fruit that can come from this.
Can I throw something out there? When did you leave for 20 years, Dr. Axton? When was that?
I left the first time in 1980, then 1984. Left and came back in 2005.
Okay. Do you remember off the top of your head when Love and Respect was written, Megan?
I don't remember off the top of my head, though. I could Google it really quickly. I feel like we started doing it at my church because they did a whole sermon series to launch it, and then it became the top marriage counseling curriculum that they've used both for premarital and postmarital counseling. I feel like that had to have been like in the 2009-2010 range, because it was before I went away to Central that they were doing it, but I think I was out of high school. I think
Love and Respect is older than that, but
it's very possible.
But that's like the number one complementarian marriage. 2004. Okay.
Oh wow, you're so much faster than me.
Go, Jess. So, because you were talking about like the shift and change, and if purity culture was the stuff that's geared towards teens and singles, then Love and Respect is that same package, but just to a slightly different age bracket. It's the same stuff. There's the same teachings of you are responsible for your husband's libido. You can't say no. If you say no, then he's going to go to porn and then it's your fault. Just all of that.
Your job, like, an administrator, Faith heard it. Your job as a wife is to sexually satisfy your husband. Is that what you're describing?
Oh, that and a slew of other things. But that's when you're talking about sexual dysfunction in Christian marriages, I think that is, I mean, that's a lie that's not unique to Christendom. Like, I think the problem of women becoming objects and being portrayed as objects is not a uniquely Christian problem. I do think that it's very significant that that is people objectifying someone else for their own pleasure or making them an object and not thinking of them as a human being is the source of a lot of sin. I'm not going to say all of it, but we could get almost to the point where it's almost all of it. And that is the way that the world has treated women for millennia. And we know this, and it's not supposed to be like that in the church. And like, when you look at the statistics for child sexual abuse and those types of things, the statistics are the same whether you're Christian or not. And in one sense, that shouldn't be surprising. But in another sense, if this is the group that has the Holy Spirit, God himself indwelling you, and you're supposed to be a changed people, and you're supposed to get rid of those barriers where you're objectifying each other and not seeing each other as true image bearers, then that number should be different. I was just thinking about that when you're talking about like how that change happened, because I think, not to harp on my complementarians, but really, I just hate complementarianism. It's just the worst, because it has such a strong biblical foundation. I'm sure there's a way to do it that does not objectify people. I'm sure there's a way to do it that doesn't do something janky with the image of God. And I'm sure there's a way to do it that doesn't immediately dehumanize and enforce patriarchal and hierarchical structures of power within the church. And also doesn't, you know, fall into the heresy of the eternal subjugation of the Son. I'm sure there's a way to do it that doesn't do all of those things. I have not seen it yet. So I read The Great Sex Rescue, and it is a very good book for deconstructing a lot of the stuff. And I think one of the scariest things about that book is that you don't even have to agree with the things that you were taught. Because that's the thing. Like, I am very good at not agreeing with the things that I have heard or I have been taught. But I heard some of it. I didn't hear as much of it as you guys probably, but I still heard some of it. I was still taught some of it. And I recognized, no, that doesn't sound legit. But it doesn't matter, because there's a whole statistic set and that they present where even just hearing it from a person of quasi authority, even if you disagree with them, even if you thought it wasn't legit, even just hearing it made you more likely to be in these situations, or made you more likely to have these things, or you had these struggles afterwards because it was in your head. It's like a bad commercial for McDonald's. It doesn't matter that you know that the cheeseburger is not going to be worth it. You see the commercial enough and you know it's a lie, but you still want the cheeseburger because you still like, that's just how our brains are wired. Like, you say something that's not true long enough and it starts to feel true even when you know it's not. And like, that's honestly like the painful, scary thing for me is it's like, there is stuff that I have had to work through that my husband did not put on me, that I did not put on me, that Jesus didn't put on me, that I knew wasn't true, but it was there anyway. And the enemy used it, and it caused so much dysfunction and pain and like isolation and all of this other stuff because it was just there. And somebody who was credible thought it was true. And it's so hard to emphatically prove something wrong, especially in the spaces that we're in and the tools that we have with biblical study, you know, and like, and just this tendency that we have to favor the new. When you were talking about like, this is a new thing in the church, this is not how the church has taught this historically. Not to say that I'm against Protestants, because I'm clearly a Protestant, but like this thing where we emphasize and we appreciate this newer way of interpreting things, when it's like, well, why is it that the Spirit did not, if that was the way things were supposed to be, and this is the one good way that all Christians are supposed to live, then how come for 2,000 years the Spirit didn't lead us in that direction? Now, I mean, like, you can say, like, obviously that argument does not always work, but just like across the board, like, if this is such a newfangled thing and we just adopted it wholesale and now we're starting to see the consequences of it, I mean,
I have seen the statistics, but what Shale is describing in regard to complementarianism, that seems to be directly connected to spousal abuse, to child abuse. Statistically, in other words, there has been a rise in these things across the culture, and directly connected then to the rise of this notion of complementarianism.
One of the things I feel like that fast-tracked my pursuit into this study, actually it was during 2020, I was doing a project where I was looking at different types of things that had gone on in culture and that I found to be super problematic, but was noticing the Christian people around me either weren't paying attention on purpose, or they were very much saying the opposite of what other people were saying. Like, we don't need to listen to Black people talking about their experience because racism isn't a thing because we fixed that. Like, that was the message. Or, you know, these women are overblowing this thing, and like, Me Too is like a Marxist thing, and we shouldn't listen to any of that sort of thing. Like, those were the conversations that were happening or not happening. And so wanting to facilitate conversation with people that maybe feel too threatened by a challenge to actually accept it as a challenge and instead just feel it's an attack. And so I was working on a project at the time that was thinking about the Me Too movement and how sexual assault survivors are treated. And I was reading a book by Rachel Den Hollander, where she describes, she's the, she was a gymnast and, but didn't compete like at a super high level, but she went to the same clinic that, was run by Larry Nassar, who's the guy who assaulted all of the like really famous Olympic gymnasts. And she was one of the first people to take him to court. And she, in the book, describes how she was actually assaulted as a small child, by a teenage nursery worker in her church. And the church's response to that was, just don't tell anybody that this happened, because he's really a good kid and like all this sort of thing. And her parents, they eventually left that church, but it told her as a person, like, nobody will listen to you if you bring this up. And so it took her a long time to be able to come forward with what had happened to her. And it was only when she saw that the Indianapolis Star was doing this like report, that she reached out and said, I don't know about some of these other people, but I know about this guy. And reading her testimony and how she talks about what she was seeing, realizing that you can do everything right and still end up in an abusive situation. So there's definitely that side of it. But then she also talked about how a lot of these church spaces she was in, because at the same time the Larry Nassar trial was going on, her church that she was currently going to at the time with her husband was in the process of merging with Sovereign Grace Ministries, which was C.J. Mahaney's church, and like Joshua Harris's church, which at the time, I think it was right after Joshua Harris had left, because what they started to find out was the church had been burying abuse claims for like years and years and years and just not dealing with them and counseling people to not go to the cops and to do all these sorts of things. And she had heard about some of that. And so she went to her church leadership and said, we should not be partnering with them. We shouldn't be part of their, like, you know, church branch, because they're not responsible and they're not doing the right things. And her church then came to her husband and told him, you need to get your wife under control, and like basically shunned them. And like in the moment where she's like going through reliving the most traumatic things of her life in front of the entire world in court, she now doesn't have a church system anymore because their church is not safe and would not listen. And so thinking about it was, I think in reading that book that started to kind of like open the gates a little bit. And the more I started looking into the case after case, thing after thing that started coming up, because, and maybe it even before then, because Bill Gothard, one of his followers was Doug Phillips, who was really big in the homeschool movement. Turns out he was grooming his nanny and ended up having an affair, in air quotes, with her. He sexually assaulted her, and then tried to cover it up, and it didn't get covered up. So that had kind of happened, but that was like at the homeschool level. Like, nobody really knew about that unless you'd been a conservative homeschool person. But then it started to be people you knew about that, like, people in regular church would have heard about, that were doing things or got caught doing things, like Ravi Zacharias or things like that. And suddenly it's starting to realize, maybe this isn't a bug. Maybe this is a feature. Like, maybe we're always going to end up here, because what we've really taught and what we continue to teach allows us to never confront people who are actually deeply problematic, and always to take their side over people that have been hurt. And then one of the things that I then learned shortly after that in this abuse in the church class I took, they have statistics on and have done interviews with predatory people in church spaces, and found that a lot of them weren't even necessarily that Christian, but they chose to go there because they knew it'd be easy to victimize people there, because the system is set up such that they're given full power and authority over people that inherently trust them and think they're safe because they're in church. And you're in a system where women and especially children have no voice. Men have the only voice, especially if you're the man of God. You can have as many victims as you want, and probably nobody will stop you. And if they do stop you, they'll just shuffle you off to another church and not tell anybody about it, because they don't have to. And then you can go have more victims, and you could have like 30 or some odd churches that you victimized people at for like years and years and years, and nobody stopped you because nobody thought to look into it for more than 2 seconds. And that's, I think, complementarianism does not incentivize the church to take seriously how it treats women and children or how it treats men either, and instead allows people in power to do whatever the hell they want without any real consequences, and the people underneath them just need to suck it up because that's what it means to be obedient to Christ. And that's not true. And it doesn't have to be true. And we could do so much better than that as the church, and have done in many other parts of the world and in many other points in time. And I'm not sure what the holdup is, but I think it's because there's often just enough good. My mom has this phrase, she uses it all the time, and we'd be like, but mom, it's not that bad. Like this TV show, like whatever. And she'll be like, well, if I put a little bit of dog poop in some brownies, would you still eat them? Because it's mostly brownie, but it's just got this little turd in it. And you'd be like, seems unfair, but no, I would not eat those brownies. You know, like, I feel like at church, like there's so much good that is done and so many things that feel beneficial, and that like you're connected to a community and you have these opportunities to serve and to grow and to be challenged and to raise your kids, hopefully in a certain way. And like that, and statistics prove like being a part of a religious group is actually really good for you as a human being. Cause you know, newsflash, God made us this way. He made us to be connected both to each other and to him. So it's not that those things are bad, but how much dog poop do you want to eat in the brownie before you have to decide this isn't really a brownie anymore? This is mostly dog poop. And that's the part I feel like the church can't quite separate out. They think they have to get rid of all the good to get rid of the bad. And that's not the truth. You can keep the good and it'll be more good because you got rid of all this other stuff that was never supposed to be there in the first place. Sorry, that is two poop related analogies in one podcast. And I apologize for what you saying.
So was complementarianism what you learned in church or in school? Was that what was taught at Central?
I was not allowed to be a part of one of the classes. The professor actually told Ian to just take me out for ice cream and just skip class that day, because that is in fact what they were teaching, and they knew that I would derail the entire class.
And but then yeah, no. ironically, he never got to that topic that day, and so he had to teach on it the next week. And Shayla was there, and he opened his mouth and she's like, that's stupid. Like before he even had a chance, like finish a full thought, she had already raised an objection.
Yeah.
It was the like greatest thing ever.
Say what you will about The Chosen and its accuracies or inaccuracies. One of the things that I love is there is an ongoing thing in the scriptures about how it's the women that are following Jesus and it's the women who are funding his ministry. And there's all of these women, and most of them are not named, but there were so many women, and in so many different Bible adaptations, because they're not named and they're just an hour and a half and they're just desperately trying to get to the cross and get a couple parables in, they don't include them. But something I love about The Chosen is that like women are really given like screen time, and they've created female characters because we knew that there were characters that were not named, and they've gone to the, and now sometimes like it's interesting because they always give the women like the right answer, which I think is to try to like kind of make up for the fact, but also because they can make the women say anything that they want, and we know that the disciples are all stupid and not getting the point. So it's easier if you're going to have someone have the right answer in the show, it's going to be the women, because they're the ones that you can just make say anything because you're just writing all of their dialogue anyway. But it's just, it's so encouraging because it is the disenfranchised, and women are a protected class. We're not a minority. I mean, realistically, we shouldn't be, but historically we are, socially speaking, we generally are. And so, and that's, it's women who are drawn to Jesus. It's women who see him first. It's a woman who's first told who he is, and it's women who follow him, and it's women who go to his, like, it's the women followers that stay and suffer with him and watch him suffer. You know, it's only John that stays. All the other men run off because they're scared, but it's the women linger. And the women are the ones that know where the tomb is, and the women are the ones that take care of the body. We're not even going to get into Junia or anything like in Acts, like, because you don't even need that. You can just go with these. Just like there's a reason why women love Jesus, and there's a reason why they flock to him, because he is a man, but he is what a man is supposed to be. He is the one that sees you for who you are and sees you as a person and treats you as such. And I don't think that Jesus is the only good man out there. but I do think he's the best man out there. That's just such the weird thing that you get about purity culture is that, yeah, it both women are evil, but also women are the more spiritually mature ones, but also we can't have women be the more spiritually mature ones because the men are supposed to be in charge, but the men can't be in charge because they're actually more hormonal. But we're not going to say that they're more hormonal because that's the word that we used to tell women that they don't matter. So actually the men are just more, wait, no, we can't say emotional either because that's what we've used to gaslight women. What are we going to call, maybe we just won't talk about that part and we'll just kind of say both things simultaneously and none of them will question it. Because that's the other thing is like, I've got two boys. I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. And I am so grateful, and this is going to sound really bad, I am so grateful that I do not have a daughter right now because I do not know how I would raise a daughter. I do not know how I would prepare a person to be a woman of God because there's just no good way to do it. You are damned if you do and damned if you don't. And there is no good picture of it. And there is so much toxic crap out there. And yeah, there's a lot of toxic crap about what it is to be a man and to be a man of God. But there are so many better examples. And I don't have to worry about all of the storybook Bibles making it look like the boy characters are seductresses. I do have to worry about that if I had a daughter. I'm still sending those Bibles back because I don't want my boys to internalize that about women. But like, I have boys, so I can talk about what does it mean to be a man and how does a man treat a woman and what does that look like? And that's still a really overwhelming, hard conversation. But like, in one sense, it's less intimidating because I don't even know what I would do because there is no good way to be a woman. You're never going to be what other people want you to be. And it's like your job in society is to be what other people want you to be. And that's just a horrible place to be in. And there's no, and again, with that, there's no difference. Like in one sense, secular spaces can be more accommodating and more pleasant, kind. And it really shouldn't be that way. But even still, you're still an object. You're still like, oh, you're not feminist enough. Why are you staying home? Or, oh, why are you doing, like, there's just no good way to do it. And let's just ignore the trap of motherhood and what a, you will never be a good enough mom. What do you mean? Did you work? You're not with your kids all the time. What do you mean? You co-sleep? That's not safe. What do you mean? You don't co-sleep? You don't love your children? Like there is no good answer. There is nothing but guilt and shame and condemnation and just other people telling you what you need to be and how you need to be it. And like, that is just, I feel like if there is a universal female experience and it's not menstruation, then it's got to be other people telling you what you're supposed to be and how you're supposed to be it. Like
men telling us how we're supposed to be women.
Well, even just women, other women telling you how you're supposed to be, because it's not, I wish it was just the men. That would,
right.
Then I could just say men suck, but it's not, you know? I mean, that was part of Megan's point about that I don't want to say the older generation, but that 35 to 60 range of women, you know, who maybe you've perpetuated this. I got loud. I'm sorry. It comes in waves.
That's why we love you.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. You've all sort of found a space. You know, this was kind of my experience in Japan, that if you had to characterize Japan outwardly, you would say, well, this is clearly a patriarchal society, and in many ways it is. But it's also true that, and I'm not claiming I completely understand, but what happens in another way is that there is a space that's opened up for women in Japan, so that very often women are the people that come to church and can become Christian, precisely because their roles are not so strictly defined by the job. You know, for a man, what in Japan, your job, your work, it's stifling for men. And women then turn out to be more socially flexible to be able to negotiate these spaces and consider things and be interesting intellectually and spiritually, that many men just are kind of boring, you know. I don't know if it works out, but I see the Japan example as, in a sense, and I don't mean to commit the over-stereotype the other way, But in a Lacanian psychoanalysis, you've probably all heard this, you know, there is the masculine orientation, and then there's the feminine orientation, which has nothing to do with gender. It's just describing this. And in a Lacanian understanding, of course, he's privileging the feminine, because the feminine precisely has this mobility of thought. That if you take Paul's example at the beginning of Romans 7, 1 to 3, it's the person defined by their relationship to the law that is masculine in a Lacanian understanding. And it's the woman in Paul's illustration that in fact escapes that. And what you're describing is this mobility, and that's what I've encountered in all of you, is there's this capacity for thought, that there's a freedom there that can be unleashed precisely from what might otherwise. And go ahead, tear that apart in some way. I don't mind. But
well, I actually was just thinking about, I read this, it was in Sheila Gregoire's book, and she was talking about this concept that girls talk too much. And that's a thing. It's said a lot in culture, but it's also said an awful lot in church, because it's a teenage version of women should be silent in church. And so it's an easy thing for people to back up. And that James Dobson, ironically, was the first one to popularize this idea that women talk and use twice as many words in a day as men. And that he quoted all these like supposed studies in one of his books, that he was the first one to kind of say it. And then several people since then, both inside the church and outside the church, have taken it and ran with it. And scientists were curious about that and kind of started looking into it. And what they found was there is no study that has been done that proves that. As a matter of fact, the opposite is true, that men and women talk about the same amount of words in a given day. And that at an individual level, there are some people that are just more chatty than others, but that's not based on gender. It's just based on personality. And they were looking at this idea of when you say that to a girl, what kind of fruit does that bear? But one of the things they talked about in there was that same idea of like men mature or women mature faster than men, or often more spiritually mature or emotionally mature than men. And one of the authors had, it was almost kind of a throwaway line even, of when people say that, what they never say next is men should look to women as examples of what spiritual, mental, emotional maturity might look like, instead of telling girls to be silent and dismissing them as, oh, girls just mature faster than boys and boys don't have to mature at all. What should be said is, if you see a girl who is very capable, deals with her emotions, is articulate about the things that she believes and understands, maybe she's an example for you of how to move forward, instead of just dismissing her as, oh, well, she's more mature, but I don't have to be like her because she's a girl. That women are given all these examples of men who've done all these things and told, well, you know, you can be brave like David, or, you know, you can be strong like Samson, or whatever those things might be. But nobody ever turns around and says, well, why don't you pray like Mary and learn how to, you know, uphold the oppressed? And why don't you wait with expectation like Hannah, or like even Mary Magdalene at the tomb? You know, why aren't you willing to go and to teach the things of God like Phoebe or Junia? Like, nobody ever gives those examples out, because that would be weird, but it also might be the best possible thing. And it's interesting because Shayla was talking about how, you know, she's got two boys that she's raising, and that it's much less frightening than having to raise a girl. That was actually one of the things that when my sister had my niece, I remember in the moment I realized, because my sister and my brother-in-law, they didn't peek ahead of time. They wanted to have that movie moment where somebody holds the baby up and goes, it's a boy or it's a girl. And like everybody like loses it. So they didn't peek at all. They had no idea what they were getting until she was there, and they held her up over the curtain, and it's like, oh my gosh, it's a girl. And so my sister, she does the big reveal over FaceTime, because of course it's COVID and we can't be at the hospital, so we're all on the FaceTime, like crowded around amongst all the grandparents and stuff, and I like got this much space to try to see, and I caught the tip of a pink hat, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's a girl. And the room went ballistic, and while everybody is like all excited because the baby is here and everything's great, the first thought I had after it's a girl and was so excited to have a niece was, oh my God, it's a girl. And now what are we going to do? And what was really interesting was my sister and I never talked about this until very recently. It was like a month or two ago. I made a post about that, kind of that feeling of like pure elation to just like abject terror of like, if nothing changes, Betty's going to have to go through all the same things I've gone through. And it's so hard to have to like unlearn all of that, especially when like secular culture isn't technically a whole lot better. And so, and I was talking about it with my sister, and she'd had the exact same thought, like this moment of elation because you've delivered a healthy baby after she'd been in labor for like 60 hours, just the work of it. And like, she's healthy, she's here, like, oh my gosh. And then her very next thought was, oh my gosh, I have a girl. What am I going to do? And so that kind of feeling of how do we make a world where, you know, both my niece and my nephew don't grow up feeling like they have to be a perverted version of a human being in order to follow God. Like, I don't want my nephew to hear that he is biologically created, that he can't stop himself from lusting, and that he has to rely on other people around him to just not do certain things so he won't sin. That's an awful thing to tell him, that he's not redeemable, that Jesus can't save him or transform his mind or his heart or his emotions or even his biological urges to be more Christ-like. I also don't want my niece to hear that she's an object that should just roll over and, like, you know, let other people do things, and she just has to stand by on the sidelines and watch and make some cookies and keep the house, because that's not fair to her either. Like, I don't want either one of them to have to grow up in a world where that is true. And they don't have to, because that's not what the church teaches. But it's not what the church should teach. It is technically what the church teaches way too often, but that's not what you see Jesus doing. And it's not what has to go forward. That's all, as Forrest Gump says, that's all I have to say about that.
I think just to say, like I know we're sitting here talking about this experience as a woman, because I don't have anything else, any other experience to be had, but I do also recognize the effect that this patriarchal burden that we've had to bear, like those men who are trying to break out of it, it's also really hard on them as well. Not, I wouldn't say like as hard, like it's not comparative, but like as they're trying to break out of that and being told, like, Jesus showed in a range of like a range of emotions and supported women, and you are also allowed to do that. And so as we are like applauding those men, like, you know, thank you for, you know, breaking out of this mold. You know, if you need to cry, you're allowed to cry. Like, you don't have to just be happy and angry. Like, there's a whole range of emotions that, like, and we're celebrating that with them, like, that there's still that oppressiveness on them from other men, just questioning them and what they're doing and putting that back on us as like, this is your fault. Like, I know within my conservative community that I grew up in, like, toxic masculinity as is a theory back home. And it's like, we're just trying to make men more feminine. But the more that I read my Bible, the more that I get to know Jesus, the more I see that he represented both. I mean, he was probably a little more masculine because he was a man, but there are definitely many times where he showed like the more feminine side, and, you know, he cried and he mourned with people and he hugged his friends and whatever the heck a holy kiss is, like, I don't know, something in there. Those are things to be celebrated. And if we are going to have a God who came down as a man, there has to be a way that we relate to him also, because he created us. And I, like, as much as I am battling for my own experience to be eradicated, I, like, for the future generations, I also hope that for the boys as well. There, and I just learning all of that through being in youth ministry, and knowing, how do I teach these boys from an experience that I don't have, which I feel like not a lot of youth ministers who are males have to think about. This is the way it's always been taught. And so they don't have to think about that. But it's from the other way around. It's like, what do I want to be saying to these boys who can't relate to my experience? And through that, and just seeing the freedom that boys and girls get alike when you teach them that Jesus relates to everyone. And it's so simple. It is so simple to say out loud, but that's because he made it simple. He told us, my burden is light. It's not easy, but it's simple. I'm fighting for those men as much as for myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think my only thing would just be so many of the problems that we are seeing in the church when it comes to men and women are not unique to the church. This is, I'm going to say this in a diplomatic way. As a culture and as a society, we do not agree on what makes a man and what makes a woman a woman. And we do not agree on what overlap there may or may not be in different categories. We don't agree on that in the secular sphere. We don't agree on that in the sphere. We don't know how to not objectify women in the secular world. We seem to not be able to figure out how to not objectify each other in the church. And the thing is, on one hand, that's completely, like, it's completely understandable, but the church is supposed to not be like the world. Okay. This is a very human problem. It's a very clear problem, but we're supposed to be better than that. If there is a place where people are supposed to be accepted and loved, where we're not supposed to objectify, where we're not supposed to other people anymore, like this very simple, but very difficult thing of what it means to love each other. This is something that the church is called to do. So the church needs to stop looking like the world in the way that we treat each other, in the way that we like, and that sounds like, I hate saying it because it sounds so pedantic, so like prescriptive and just like, oh, the church needs to get its act together. But I mean, a little bit, yeah. But just like, you know, we're not, we talk about not being like the world sometimes in evangelical circles, and we take that to mean, oh, we should look different. We should wear long skirts. We should do this. And what that actually means is the way that we think about each other should be different. And the way that we function in the world should be different. And the things that we're trying to prove and the things that we want to fight for should be different. I think the church can be better. It needs to be better. But also, like, if we can actually act like Jesus, you know, as best we can, we're getting closer to that all the time. And that's, Jesus is the one that draws us in. That's why we're still here. It's not because of the church that I'm still here, you know? Yeah. The church is full of people who suck, but it's also like full of people who have been how Jesus has like made himself known.
Yeah.
And so if we can do more of that and less of the other, I think we're going in a good direction. Crying out loud. It should not be this difficult. It's very simple.
Yeah. Whenever I summed up my Sermon on the Mount lesson at the end of it, because it took us a while to get through because they had so many great questions, I asked them, I was like, so what is this sermon? Because this is one sermon. It's not, you know, these little choppy pieces. You know, when you sit in a sermon in big church, the whole thing is about one thing. And what would you say that one thing is? And my kids decided Jesus is preaching about how all he really cares about is your heart. And I think we forget that. We call it a heart issue, but we're more worried about things on the outside. But Jesus is more worried about our heart.
Well, because if your heart's in the right place, then your hands will be too, right?
That'll preach.
Mm.
Not just where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Oh, yeah. That too.
It's almost as if Jesus said that,
right? It's
almost like he knows. Like he was right there before the foundation. Like he's God incarnate. What?
What? Hold on.
What? I don't know.
I think a final thought would be, this is something I was actually just on a podcast about a month ago, and I said the same thing, and I got some people. One of the hardest parts of this journey has been doing this work as an artist in the contemporary art scene and like still being a practicing Christian, talking about and critiquing the church, because there's a lot of artists that critique the church that are not a part of the church, even if they were before, and they're very happy to just be like, the church sucks and it all sucks and we'll just burn it down. And there are a lot of artists that are Christians, but who don't really have any desire, it would seem, to critique the things of God that are not the things of God, but the things of the church, and are very content to make very profound and deeply interesting work about God and Jesus and theology and like the stories that are given to us in scripture, but very rarely will go all the way into like a full-blown critique of what's currently happening in our culture. And so I was complaining to my mom about it one day. I'm like, I just feel like I'm out here by myself, and I know that can't be true. And she reminded me of the story of Elijah, when he was laying in the desert going, please just kill me. It'd be better off for everybody. And God's like, would you just take a nap and eat a sandwich? And then he had to repeat that process because he still, after one nap and sandwich, was not prepared to go back into it. And then God took him to the mountain and was like, I'm going to pass by. And he didn't come in the loud noises or in the big swirling winds or in the fire. He came in the still small voice. And when he showed up, he told Elijah, I have saved 500 people for you, and I'm sending you Elisha to be your right hand. You are not alone. He was never alone. He was there when the crows were dropping off his lunch, and he was there when the angels came and ministered to him and told him, why don't you just sleep? You'll feel better about life. And he was there with him when he was roasting the prophets of Baal, both figuratively and literally. And he was still there with him all the way up until that fiery chariot came to get him. And that was kind of the thing like that I needed desperately to hear is I'm not the only one out there. There are more people out there that have creative and artistic talents that are deeply, deeply in love with Jesus and want to follow him in a faithful way, but are also very disturbed by the things that they're seeing in church. And essentially what I want to say to that is, if that's you, do it and do it out loud. And use the gifts that God has given you, whether that's writing, you know, for pastors, being a pastor and writing a sermon is an art form. To be able to deliver a message, to use metaphor appropriately, to be able to encourage people onto love and good deeds, like that is an art. If your art is writing sermons, use that in a way to change the church. If your art is gardening or like making amazing food, use that as an opportunity to bring hospitality and to have conversation around a table about how we can make things better. If your art is about, you know, sewing or like doing things with like fabric or knitting, like you can have conversations about modesty really easily. And like, how do we rethink how we present our bodies in culture around us? If your art is more traditional, like traditional in air quotes, like visual art thing, like whether it's painting or photography or music or any of those kinds of things, like we have such an opportunity to help the church see a bigger vision for what we can be and what we should be and how we can get there, that we do ourselves a disservice and we probably quite honestly are limiting our vocation when we choose not to. And that's not to shame somebody to say, well, you should have been talking about this and you're not, because the honest truth is it's really difficult to put your pain out there for everybody to see and do it while you're sorting through it. Because there have been so many moments where I wish I wasn't unpacking these suitcases while broadcasting it to the entire world. But at the same time, I don't want anybody to live in fear of, because it's hard, because it might be painful, I just won't do it. Like, perfect love casts out fear. And you can't have fear in art. It just doesn't work. You know, it will always limit the way that you're able to express yourself and the vision that you're able to share with others. And I think there's such an opportunity for visual artists, for writers, for cooks, for people who do all kinds of fabric and textile art, for people that deeply love music, for people that like to do speaking and drama and dance, like all of those kinds of things. We have an opportunity to show a vision of what it means to be human, what it means to be created in the image of God, and what it means to love each other and to love the world around us. And we can do that while also pointing out we've not always been great at those things, and we need to repent of that in an appropriate way and make restitution and then find a way to move forward in reconciliation. And so that's kind of my pitch. If you want to reach out to me, I would be more than happy to talk to anybody that wants to collaborate and think through, or even just say, hey, you're not alone. Like, we're all out here. We're hiding somewhere in our own corners trying to do this thing. And then the final thing is my show, our show, I keep saying my show and I feel weird about it because it might've started off as a solo idea, but it's not really a solo show in the traditional sense because it's collaboratively built by myself and 22 other people and then some. But it will be at Intersect Art Center in South City, St. Louis in December and January of this year. So all of, I think it opens the week after Thanksgiving. And it'll be up through, I think, January 26th, maybe. And there'll be some events and things posted. So if people follow me on social media, that'll be the best way to see like opening dates and various events and things like that. But you'll get to see the work that we have done together as a group and the things that we've had to say. And hopefully either you'll be challenged by it or you'll be encouraged by it. That's my goal. And so, yeah, everybody is welcome to come. So.
All right. My goal is to get to your show. I think we missed your display at WashU.
Yeah, it was just came down. Actually, I just had to go pick up all the artwork last week, Tuesday.
Okay, so I'll make sure we want to get to the show. And thank you all so much. This has been wonderful. And your description, you know, I hope that Forging Plowshares provides a place to the ministry that we're doing. Is here is people that might otherwise feel like you're Elijah out in the wilderness by yourself. But no, there's other people that think similar.
Forging Plowshares is a community dedicated to cultivating the peaceful kingdom by providing in-depth, transformative biblical and theological education and discipleship. If you have found this podcast valuable, please remember to share on social media. If you have questions about what you've heard, or if you'd like to learn more about how you can get involved with Forging Plowshares or even support this ministry financially, please visit our website, forgingplowshares.org.